This week on the Inside Flap.
No matter how famous somebody is, they're the same as you. I think people forget that. People ask me questions sometimes about, I don't know, war or politics. And I want to say, look, what do I know? I mean, I'm a writer. I'm a kids writer. I'm a crime writer. I don't know anything. I think the most famous actors I've met probably left school when they were 15 or 16, and they don't know very much either. They are still my heroes and heroines, and they are fantastic to me. But I've sort of, as I've got older, lost that sense of, oh my God, it's.
Why would you cut one, a perfectly good headset?
I agree, Andrew.
Why wouldn't you just leave it dangling?
This is what I said. Okay. That's what I asked him.
Yeah, and,
he said, oh, I find it annoying.
It's heavy.
He didn't find it that annoying to stick it in and have the other one dangling. I had to use the crappy one.
It's heavy. It swings around like a pendulum.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room to my slight right, that's Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And resting comfortably on the couch. You got your shoe up on the couch.
Well, because the dogs love the way my sneakers smell.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
only the best for Nelson.
That's Andrew Dowd, and welcome. Oh, I'm sorry.
Excelsior.
Welcome to episode number, what are we up to? 249.
Wow.
The Inside Flap Book Podcast. Got a great show for you today. We are joined by one of my personal favorites. Anthony Horowitz is on the show today. Love Anthony. Love his books so much. His new one out now. It's another one in the Hawthorne and Horowitz series. It's called Close to Death, number 5 in the series. So funny, so good. We'll have that conversation for you in just a second. But first, you know, it is a testing week here in Denver Public Schools and Littleton Public Schools as well. I don't know if your kids
Douglas
are doing
County as well. Yeah,
Douglas County as well. So at East, what they do, so I have to proctor on Thursday. So they give two teachers 2 days to proctor, and most teachers just divvy it up. So the other guy took Monday, the speech teacher, who I found out, I found out a little more about, I talked about the speech teacher before, how he was
the one who hid under his desk.
Hid under his desk.
I know this one.
So he will not be coming back next year.
I'm not surprised.
No surprise to anybody else. Yeah, anybody in our building. Apparently he likes to do, because I talked to Knowledge, because Knowledge works in his he works in the speech and debate program. He's in the classroom with him a lot. He stays after till like 9 o'clock at night, playing video games on his computer.
Really?
Yes. I said, I thought he was married. And I was just like, oh, he's married. He just doesn't want to go home. I said, oh, okay.
Oh,
so that's what he does.
Does he have kids?
So he's not just hiding under his desk.
No.
He's hiding from his wife. He's hiding from the world.
So,
Now, is your network, he does not have kids as far as,
that's
from
good.
What I know.
That's
yeah.
good.
Is the internet that good at your school? At your school that he gets?
Oh, yeah,
it's a, it's a high-flying internet. Yeah,
is it absolutely. Really?
Oh, yeah. It's massively fast.
Oh.
It's faster than our
that's what he wants to do.
Internet here.
So a lot of the gaming, there's a lot of people that spend way too much time online gaming.
Yeah.
I may be one of them.
I was thinking that I might be looking at one
yeah,
of those.
But I'm not. It's funny you should mention that.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm not somebody that basically, so what I do is I don't wear headphones. I don't even turn the audio on.
Yeah, smart.
I'll play the video games like so I can talk, I can see what's going on around the house, and I don't play as much as I used to.
So when you're talking video games, you're talking online gaming.
Online gaming.
Yeah, online with other people.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it is.
That's smart. Like, you don't want to put those headphones on.
What is it, World of Warcraft? Is that the one that everyone plays?
Well, there's lots of them.
There's lots.
There's
Andrew
dozens.
Plays League of
Legends.
Andrew plays
okay,
League
okay.
of Legends.
Just curious.
And it's, you know, and what's interesting is these are like a chess match. They're designed. I mean, they are amazing, you know, and there's other people. I mean, there's other people you're playing with. But, you know, they are amazing. right? It's like a chess match
yeah.
with all these different, with, you know, thousands
people
and thousands
from all
of,
over the world.
And that's it, thousands and thousands of variables.
I can always tell when Andrew's online playing, when I'm talking to him on the phone, because what I hear is, let me see if I can replicate it here. basically, I don't know what's going on with this game, but this is what I hear when he's on it. yeah. I can hear that. Just the clap.
So there could be...
I don't know what is going on that you got to clack the keyboard that fast.
There could be multiple
hard.
Things. I mean, that's the way these... It's not a joystick. You get your keyboard
so
and the mouse.
You're in full support of this guy playing his...
Of course,
because of the high-speed internet.
No, I mean, he obviously...
He's all for it.
He's obviously doing it to where it's basically taking over his personal life.
Mm-hmm. I don't think
that's that's a problem.
I think the video, it could be he's staying there to read. He's staying there watching TV. It doesn't matter. He just doesn't want to go home. Mm. That's all that's going on. But anyway, so we're doing the testing. He did Monday. I'm going to do Thursday. Now, at East, I don't know, Andrew, do your kids have like half day? Do they have to go in?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Yep. So at East, and Sylvia does too, they have testing in the morning, and then that's it. Kids go home. There's nothing going on in the afternoons. But as we were reminded by our assistant principal with a strongly worded email, teachers, you are contractually obligated to be in the building, you know, from 8 to 4 or whatever it is that we assigned our contract that we have to be there.
Hmm.
So I have a friend.
I know where Shmave Medicus might have been.
I have a friend named Shmave. Shmave this morning, he went for a lovely 7-mile hike in Washington Canyon, 3,000 feet of elevation gain. Sounded like it was Shmave. Shmave had a blast going there.
Did Shmave get a text or an email or a phone
Shmave
call?
Did not,
you know?
No. Shmave was okay. It was the Shmave's phone, from what I understand, was blessedly silent.
Okay,
was absolutely wonderful for Shmave. Now So I went in this day after, I was there all day.
Right.
But in the afternoon, I was there because the dance, so we, you know, I've talked about the stage extension that we built. It made it like 20 feet longer or came out from the stage 20 feet more, and it's like 40 feet wide. And we built this massive, weeks and weeks and weeks building this massive extension because the seats are so far back. So we wanted to get the audience closer to the action. So we built this out. The stage curves, so it's really hard to connect it. And then we did it last year for Chicago, did it again this year for Urinetown. Last year, you know, the choir teacher insisted that we take it down because he couldn't possibly have a concert on that because of the sound, the positioning of the speakers, all this stuff. Well, this year, the choir teacher agreed to have the concert on there. It was a different choir teacher. Mm-hmm. And the dance teacher said, yeah, leave it up. I'll have my dancers dance on it. It'll be great. Well, she changed her mind.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So I was able to talk to her, and we compromised. She wants half of it removed.
Oh.
So now all of our kids, unfortunately, they don't have to. They're working on senior projects, so they're very busy. They don't have time. So that means it falls on this guy with the two thumbs. I'm talking about this guy.
Dave Medicus.
Right here. So I was in there this afternoon. Now, I thought I could go in there. I pop in my AirPods. I put on my audiobook. And all afternoon, I can spend all afternoon just taking everything apart or half of the stage apart. Easy peasy. When I go in there, there's like 100 dance kids in there. They're all in there rehearsing. And what I hear is, it is so
club,
loud.
Club level?
Yeah, it's like walking into a club and the dance teacher's on the back. 5, 6, 7, 8, turn, jump, and now twist, turn. And she's shouting into the microphone. The music is so loud. No lie, I put in my AirPods. I couldn't
just
obviously,
to muffle it.
I couldn't hear. Right, yeah, I couldn't hear my audio, but I actually turned it up 100%.
Oh, Dave, you're
loud.
Killing
well,
me.
Well, I just to check.
What's that?
I still. Yeah. Huh? You say? I still couldn't hear it. I ended up.
I got a story about you, Dave Medicus, that I'm going to tell after this.
Okay,
that just reminded me.
Listening to a sports podcast, but And I could barely hear that. But I had to go like, they're wearing socks or they're bare feet or they're very thin shoes. So I had to, you know, make sure I'm not throwing screws all around as I'm dismantling this whole thing.
Hurt.
There's a million screws. And they're like, three inchers, big ones, sharp ones.
While they're dancing and rehearsing, you're doing
this?
Well,
they're back on the stage, so they laid the Marley down, surface material.
What's the Marley?
Marley is, it's like a sticky surface.
Bob? Okay.
Not Bob Marley. it's a flooring, so it's what they dance on.
Okay,
it's
not, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they don't slip on it.
Is it invisible, kind of?
No, it's just dark.
Oh, okay.
It comes in like big...
Did you know about that, Andrew?
You ever heard of Marley?
Oh, absolutely not.
So they're dancing on the stage. As I was told, the stage that I built or that we built, their dancers would get hurt because we're doing technical dancing and we can't dance on those platforms you built.
Oh, do they move?
And they don't move, but there's gaps in between. I mean, they're not, it's not perfectly, not tiny gaps, you know, but it's not like, these are high school kids who built this. So,
yeah.
And it works great for the musical, but as she said, they're doing quote unquote technical dancing. And these are kids who've been dancing all their lives. She said, I cannot risk having them get hurt.
That makes sense.
You know, I said, oh yeah, great.
So I've been to a few performances in this theater. And so this theater is... How many years old?
100 this year.
Yeah, 100 years old this year.
So it's 100 years old.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as far as the performances have been in there, so one time we're sitting in like the first row and it's like, I mean.
Oh, that was brutal.
Yeah, for Chicago.
It was 137 degrees and we're in the front row.
Then there's that too.
Yeah.
And then, and so the last time I was in there for Urinetown, I looked up and I'm like looking at the theater. I'm really studying it.
Oh, nice. What did you think?
Well, and you could see one, at some point they added these high-tech sound system in there.
Yes.
Like, those speakers,
speakers
are just, like, amazing because the problem is a 100-year-old theater, like, you know what I mean? It needs some TLC.
Oh, yeah. And so, we still have terrible sound problems, as you would have heard from the feedback we get all the time.
Still, but but I'm sitting there looking, well, it's like, but they've got the sound system to try. I mean, it must have been much worse before.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that theater deserves a major, major overhaul.
I think so,
too.
Oh,
it does.
It could be beautiful.
Yeah.
Well,
it already is pretty.
It is.
Pretty.
It's historic. It's
it already
nice,
is pretty. Yeah.
But, yeah, it could
but
be
the audio...
We need some padded seats.
Padded seats.
The air conditioning.
Nice.
Air conditioning
the
would
air
be
conditioning
great.
In there.
Air conditioning would be amazing.
The hard wooden chairs
the,
right
the
now.
The positioning. The stage probably needs to be bigger and needs to be like more adaptable, but... You know, I don't know, Dave, if you're going to start a fundraiser to renovate the theater project.
Yeah, that would be great. Send your money to East High School. Now, yeah, because she wants half the stage gone because they're going to have a dance down in the pit area. So she wants to have one of the dances there. So apparently, so Nat came up to us last week. Mm-hmm. Laura, you remember Nat.
Sure.
And she said a dance student now. She came up to Deb and I and she said, oh, yeah, Miss Shannon said now she wants all the stage taken apart. And then you might have actually heard this from Castle Pines all the way down in Castle Pines when Deb and I both said, no!
Oh, Nelson, it's okay, Nelson. Buddy.
And
oh, no.
He jerked his head up.
You're
the
good
dog.
Good
he
boy.
Knows that word.
You're the best in the world.
That's
so
sad.
I assume she went back to Shannon with that message because there's been no more talk of dismantling all of the stage. And I got to make a throne for the Queen of Hearts, so that's going to be fun.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Huh.
By Friday.
Are you playing with the Queen of Hearts? That's
playing with the Queen of Hearts. Laura, how? Oh, you said you had a story.
I have a story that I remembered when you were telling this.
Yeah.
So we talked to a writer who's, I think, pretty well known, Sarah Paretsky. I was really excited to talk to her.
Yes.
Before the thing, Dave happened to be home that day.
And we'll have that show for you this week.
Yeah. And before the interview, Dave got us some new headphones for interviews because I feel like we look like...
You don't want to wear the big... We
look like dorks when we wear a big headphone and then the author has nothing on. It's fine when all three of us are wearing the same gear.
Right.
But when it's Dave and I with our dorky headphones on and the author looks free and clear, we've gotten made fun of by authors before.
We have. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who was that who told us we were like something out of a Saturday Night Live sketch?
Oh, he's a really nice guy. But I can't remember.
And you didn't consider that as a compliment?
We did go with it at the time, but I remember thinking, it is dorky.
It's like, you guys look like the NPR, the Alec Baldwin sweaty balls.
Sweaty balls.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. I mean, that's high praise.
It was high praise. So he got these real slim little earbuds, right?
Little earbuds. And the reason we wear them is so we can conduct the interview using our microphones.
He scampers off.
I'm thinking about you, listener.
I put mine in.
Right.
He scampers off. He comes back with scissors.
Right.
And he very quickly, Andrew, snips off one of the earbuds.
The left one, yeah.
on mine. No, you claimed you didn't know which one it was. You snipped it off.
Yeah.
And then you're like, you picked mine up and you're like, here, I'll get yours too. And I was like, no, no, I want both ears in.
Right.
And then he proceeds to sit down and then he realizes he's cut off the wrong one.
The wrong one, yeah.
Also, because he's deaf in one ear.
My
so
left ear, yeah.
He cut off the wrong one. So Sarah Paretsky was a little bit late, no big deal. So I went back to my work,
right.
Whatever. She comes on, so I come running in. Dave's already chatting with her. I sit down, and then I realize he's given himself the the intact two headphone.
Right. Even though
earbuds.
I don't have the left one in my left ear, I still only have one ear in.
And I have to deal with the crappy one that he had cut the thing off.
Yeah.
And because like I couldn't hear, I don't know, but the volume was jacked way up. And my ear hurt after the interview. And halfway through the interview, I got the giggles because I realized like that you were there with the one earphone just dangling down, chatting away.
Yeah. So I must be missing something here.
Yeah.
Why would you cut one, a perfectly good headset?
I agree, Andrew.
Why wouldn't you just leave it dangling?
Because this is what I said.
Okay.
That's what I asked him.
Yeah, and
he said, I find it annoying.
It's heavy.
He didn't find it that annoying to stick it in and have the other one dangling. I had to use the crappy one.
It's heavy. It swings around like a pendulum.
He was fine talking to Sarah. I doubt you even noticed.
I tell you, this Dave Medicus has got some quirks.
He's a character. So I've had to deal with that. With him just looking at the scissors, he grabs my headphones and he's like, I'll cut yours off too. I'm like, no. I want my stereo.
I forget everybody's not deaf in their
hearing.
Left ear.
But Andrew, how have you been?
You know, it's the usual busy. Mm-hmm. And what I'll tell you is
the only guy who quits his job or gets fired from his job half, let's face it, he wasn't putting a lot of effort in that job, didn't really want to keep it, but the only guy who loses his job and then complains about being busy.
Yeah, I did. So they gave me the choice, so I could have resigned, but I basically said fire me because I want to make sure I can get my benefits.
Yeah, that
right?
makes sense. Yeah,
but in any event,
you were not brokenhearted over losing this job.
No, absolutely not. That job was hell.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, thankless, like long hours and, mm-hmm. and just it didn't really matter.
Right.
But in any event, I've been spending time on my health. I saw one of the top knee specialists in the country.
Oh.
Dr. Hackett.
Oh.
Buddy Hackett.
Oh, that's why he's up in the mountains. That makes sense.
Up in Frisco. I mean, all kinds of celebrity endorsements from the guy.
That makes sense.
And, basically see, well, what should I do about my knee? And he basically said, and so I got the advice and he basically said, lose some damn weight, Andrew.
Is that what he said?
That was it.
Did doctors phrase that?
Well, so.
Yeah, I would like to know.
So I already told him I've lost like 20 pounds.
Okay.
Which I have.
All right.
And I said, and I'm like, my knee continues to improve.
Okay.
I'm like, and I intend to lose more weight.
So he didn't say surgery.
So we did the analysis. We did all this stuff. And he basically said, I could operate. He said, it's really not going to do you much good. He's like, we can try this other treatment, which are these injections. He's like, if you hit a wall, we can try those.
Okay.
But he basically, like, after we went through all the shtick,
yeah,
he basically said, now let me talk to you about weight loss. And, he basically said, for every pound that you lose, sometimes it affects the pressure in your knees 7 times.
Wow.
Right?
Really?
And he's like, and there's some areas of your knees where it will actually affect it even more than that.
Mm. Wow.
So he's like, you've done the right thing losing the weight.
That's
great. He's like, you you got to keep it up.
That's great.
Now, how have you lost the weight?
So one, without a doubt, it's like, it's eating healthier, not going back for a second helping. So eating healthier is part of it. But yeah. I wouldn't say it's dramatic in terms of like what I'm doing different as far as eating. But it's that, and it's exercising. Like today, I walked the dogs for a mile. I went down and worked out for like 30 minutes or so in the basement. But to be honest, if I exercise an hour a day, like a moderate hour a day,
and your knee is able to do some light exercise,
that's good. If I exercise an hour a day
and watch what I eat,
I continue to lose a few pounds.
Oh man,
here and there.
That's great.
All right, yeah. Very good.
I exercise. I don't know. I feel like I'd like to lose like 5.
Yeah,
I'm stuck. I don't. Yeah, without like that's the thing too, because you don't want to starve yourself. Because then you starve yourself. Sure, you can drop it.
Right,
it comes right back.
No, yeah. It does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I got to amp up my my cardio.
Well, yeah, we're getting in the right time of year to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and weight training is important too.
That's true. It is, especially as we get older.
Yeah, and that's...
You're right.
And that's what I've had... I've had two separate doctors tell me...
You're right.
You know, the weight training is just as important because I guess the muscles are burning fat 24/7.
I definitely need to do that.
Burning calories.
And weight training, frankly, is easier than cardio, so I would not mind.
Well, you mix it up. You
doing
make,
that.
You mix it up.
Yeah.
So let me tell you about another situation.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, this is sort of a public service announcement, but basically we have a 15-year-old son, right? He turned 15 last week.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved to a new school system, and this is a kid who is straight A student, great kid, great student, like kind.
Smart.
Smart, considerate.
Yeah.
So in any case, we moved to a new school and we're thinking, oh, you know, he's going to do marching band, he'll make friends there, etc. Well, we had his birthday weekend where his friends from his old school came over and spent 2 days with him. Then he had to go back to this new high school.
Oh.
And he's a freshman.
He's
at
a freshman.
School. Yeah.
Yep. And so basically, he came home that week and basically he finally, what do you call it? He, you know, he was in tears. He basically
broke down.
He broke down.
Mm. Yeah.
And he, you know, and he talked to his mom, and I will say thank God for Katie because he's comfortable talking to Katie about stuff like this,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily comfortable talking to me.
It's
about
so nice to have a parent that you can do that with. Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, and I'm there to talk to. It's just whatever he feels, you know, he feels comfortable talking to Katie. So great. So he basically said, you know, look, after being at that school for a year, I do not have a single friend.
That's rough.
He sits in the cafeteria and
makes
eats
your heart hurt.
And eats lunch by himself every day. I mean, again, he was in marching band, straight A student. He was like student of the month 1 month.
Why is it? It is hard to make friends. Why is it so hard?
It is.
Yeah, I don't know. And this is a, like, as far as the school goes,
I don't think he's alone.
It's a very cliquey school and things like that.
Oh.
But you know, this is a kid that's a star student. And so finally we're like, we're just like, well, you know, what are we going to do? And he's like, I don't want to go back there in the fall. And so we started the wheels turning and we still don't know what the answer is. But the good news is the fact that we've actually discussed it and it's out in the open.
It's made him feel better.
Feel better and we'll find a solution.
That's great.
But we're not just simply going to, we're not just simply.
Force him.
Yeah, force him. And
no,
we're not going to accept it. We think we have a solution, knock on wood. It's just a question of. We need to see if things, if we get approval.
It's so dangerous for kids that age too. And the fact that he shared and felt comfortable is fantastic.
Yeah, that's what you want.
Yeah. And I like, and I have a friend of mine, and I used to work with his cousin, and his cousin had a 14-year-old son who had some issues. And let's just say it didn't go well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what you want to try to avoid.
You hear more and more about it. It's prevalent. Yeah.
So, and you know, and even as I look at becoming a teacher, and whether I teach middle school
is
or
that
high
a,
school.
Wait, is that a mic drop right there? Have we talked about that on the show?
I don't know
if we, I don't know
have
if we have. This is career change
Andrew's
for Andrew Dowd.
Looking for a new, Andrew has seen.
He wants to be punished some more.
The life of Riley that Shmave lives where he can
That's
go for
true.
A 7 mile hike.
That's true. Ding, ding, ding.
Testing weeks and says, hey, wait a second. What am I doing busting my ass? I can get a teaching job and get health insurance.
This is true.
You know, he's looking into that.
Well, and the reason is, I'll be making $100,000 less a year. You know, so be it. But it just comes down to just working in the corporate environment. Basically, like more and more, it's just why. I mean, other than the paycheck, do I enjoy it? No. Does what I do really matter? No. I mean, there's no, like the Maslow's hierarchy, there's really no self-esteem. There's no higher purpose to what I'm doing.
It's good that you're figuring it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, do I want to spend the next 10 years? And I've got no time off. I've got no time to take care of my health. I've got no time to take care of my family. I mean,
look at Shmave. Shmave's out there living his best life. You and Shmave could go hiking on days when you're supposed to be
right.
in school.
Shmave was looking up hikes for tomorrow.
Yeah.
Shmave and Shmandrew.
Shmandrew.
Except for the three doctor's appointments I have tomorrow. Other than that. So,
I don't know if your knee would hold up to where I'm going tomorrow.
Yeah, probably.
I don't think I would hold up for where you're going to go.
But, wouldn't do that to you.
But you'll hear more about it. And I don't know, like, as far as this transition, I found a program. I've been accepted to a certain phase of the program. I haven't been finalized yet.
That's great.
But, you know, there's certainly some challenges ahead for me. which maybe I'll.
But they're fun.
I'll talk about it. Well, it's interesting. I'm kind of enjoying it.
Yeah.
And I won't be able to. And I would say maybe two things. One, like I think I can make a difference teaching. You know, so you know, and so that alone, like, and even the situation that my kids in, it's like, could I help? Even if I could help a couple students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, starting an after-school club with a couple kids, like that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Can help people.
So we'll, in any event, we'll see how it
Shmave goes. Makes a difference every day. All right, well, let's get to it. Our chat with Anthony Horowitz. His new book that is out right now, you can run right out and buy it, or you can go to Amazon and click it and get it. So good. Close to Death, book 5 in the Hawthorne and Horowitz series. I read them all. The series just keeps getting better and better. This one is almost like, and you'll hear us talk to Anthony about this, it's not a locked room mystery. It's more of a locked, gated community mystery. It's set in a small community called Riverside Close. 6 houses behind a locked gate. All the neighbors get along just fine and dandy until the new family moves in, the Kentworthies, with their annoying loud parties, loud cars, and loud children. And their plans of putting in a big old loud swimming pool. Mm. The family manages to offend each resident in the community. And before you can say cozy mystery, the father of the Kentworthy clan is found dead. So the case actually happened 5 years in the past, but Horowitz is writing it up in the present as Hawthorne doles it out to him and outlines the case for him, which makes for an interesting twist. This is another fun and funny entry in the series and a great locked room mystery. Another great fun chat with Anthony. So here now talking about his book, Close to Death. This is Anthony Horowitz. I just died in your arms tonight.
Marvelous. Right. Must have gone well the first time.
Yeah. I feel like you might have given us a hard time and we came back for more.
I'd never give anybody a hard time. I'm the easiest interviewee in the business.
I believe it. We are like the Timex watches. You know, we take a licking and keep on ticking.
Is that the... Very good.
Still I'm make pleased Timexes? To hear. I don't know. Where are you in London? We're talking to you from London.
I'm in London. I'm on the edge of London. I'm in Richmond, in my home in Richmond. Just about 30 minutes on public transport to the sort of center of town.
Nice.
Splendid.
Nice.
Splendid. We just took a group, well, not just, but last year, spring break, we took a group of students over to England. A group of theater students. Don't think we made it to Richmond, but we had a lovely time touring the fine city of London with 70 high school theater students.
Wow. Spring break. Did they destroy everything in sight?
Yes, they did.
They did, and they kept. You know what they did? They kept losing their wallets, their cell phones. Every time you turn around, there's another kid with. I think I left my cell phone on the tube.
Oh my God!
Like, all right, sorry.
It's sooner you than me. Do you go to theater with them? Do you go to theater? You say they were theater students.
Yes, I'm a high school theater. This is my theater classroom, as a matter of fact.
Okay. So did you take them to shows like at the Globe Theater in London? And
we did. We went to the Globe, we saw the Tempest there, and then we saw, what's that long-running English mystery play that we saw?
The Mousetrap.
Yes, The Mousetrap, yeah. And then Matilda, we saw that, yeah.
Oh, great.
But we won't give away the ending to The Mousetrap, because we've been...
I think I know the ending. We're all friends here, we all know the ending. Okay. There's a famous story about a taxi driver that was pulled up outside of the theater, and the woman... complained about the driving and refused to give him a tip. And as she walked into the theater, he shouted, "Lady, it was," and so told her the solution.
That's great.
A London myth.
Now, listen, we also won't give away the ending to your book, which I absolutely loved, Close to Death. Now, listen, this is a tale of poison, parking, and parakeets. Anthony, what was it that inspired you to write this fabulous mystery?
I love that poison parking and parakeets introduction. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
What inspired me was a couple of things, really. This is the fifth Hawthorne novel, and It's the first one set in Richmond, which is where I've just moved. So it's around the corner from where I live. And so I was very much inspired by my new Le Cal, which is on the edge of London, a very leafy and very beautiful place. Mm. But I've also been fascinated by the idea of neighbor feuds, you know, finding neighbors, people who live in a community. In the title of the book, we have a close, which of course is a play on words. It's both a close in the sense of a group of houses in a street, and also close to death, as in near to death. And I was just I thought to myself, it's interesting that, you know, we think about nightmare neighbors, but what if you put murder into the mix of that? So you've got a group of people who all have the same motive for killing the same person, and that changes the rules, because normally in an Agatha Christie or any sort of golden age murder mystery, everybody has a different motive, and that's part of the fun. This time it's the same. And so that was really the first thought on how I arrived at this story.
I like that. Yeah. Have you, we have a mentally unhinged neighbor or meth. We're not sure. One or the other. Drugs or mentally unhinged. Maybe both.
Maybe
have
both.
Have you had a bad neighbor? Did it ring any bells? Did you draw on that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've had various ones. I mean, there were a couple of neighbors of mine. We did some rebuilding, and this is, of course, an absolute spark for discontent. The building should have taken only a few weeks. It went on for months and months and months, and they became ever more. They turned from sort of these friendly, pleasant, let's have a cup of tea together, to psychotic, we hate you in every fiber of our being monsters. And that watching that was interesting, because it is one of the sort of the things we all put up with in life, that we, you know, Albert Camus famously said, hell is other people.
Right.
And that unfortunately is absolutely true when you are forced to live next door to somebody or above somebody or below somebody whose habits infuriate you, and you're trapped, there's nowhere to go. And so as a sort of premise for a murder story, I'm surprised it hasn't been done more often.
I know, it's so good. And it makes your blood boil, because you just want peace and quiet in your home, or you want whatever it is
it's
you want.
It's not just that, it's also, you know, in this book, Close to Death, there's, you know, I say they've all got the same motive, but there are different variations on it. So there's the kids who go on their skateboards through people's flower beds, there's the all-night parties, there's the casual racism against one of the neighbors, there's parking.
Parking
is one of the biggest sources of neighborhood fallouts in the world.
Right.
You know, somebody blocking the driveway, hedgerows, in this case it's the whole swimming pool that's being built in somebody's backyard. So, you know, there are so many different reasons why you can hate your neighbor.
We have a guy across the back alley from us. What he likes to do is play his music really loud, turns up the bass all the way, so you can literally hear it inside your house, this bass thudding. And then at night, he likes to, and this is when the drugs come into play, but he likes to shout vitriol into the air, like he's shouting at people, like people that he thinks are coming onto his property.
And what can you do? The only answer, Dave, is murder.
That's true.
I've tried talking to the guy. I think my next step is going to hopefully be murder.
Anthony Horowitz said.
That's right. If I got the okay from you.
He said that's jokingly in an ironic
way. That's not what I heard. Listen, I also like in this book, I like maps. I love a good map and a good murder mystery. And you have a map in here. And you, of course, I would flip back and forth just to get my, so I can get the layout and I remember who lives where. And you even mention this later on in the book. And we find out that, according to your character in the book, that maps cost extra. Did you have to fight for this map to be included in this book? Is that
my
true?
My poor publisher. No, look, the book they've produced over here is absolutely beautiful. They've done a really beautiful edition of the book with, there's a stamp in the cover inside with my signature. Mm. It's a beautiful piece of thing, and they've got lovely end papers and the cover and everything. I have heard somebody say that the cover is actually the most expensive part of the book. Oh. And a map does add to the cost too. But I think the real truth about this is that that's the American issue, which I love too.
Yeah.
The truth is that I think the most important thing in a murder mystery or a whodunit, particularly the quite complicated ones that I write, is that you should never be lost. You should always find your way through the book and know who everybody is and not have to keep going back. You know, who is this guy? Where does he live? What's going on here? So the map at the beginning is not only, I think, an attractive thing. It gives you a sort of a visual sense of the place. It's also a real help in just reading the book. And the cast of characters I like as well. I don't think, I'm not sure I do it in this one because I don't need to, because all the characters are named on, the,
on
map.
The map.
This is
so-and-so's
house, and this is his house, and Roderick Brown lives up here. Right. But I just love the way that a map gives you an immediate sort of physicality, an understanding of the physicality. I think that, you know, I think Hawthorne jokes at one stage, he's read the first chapters I've written, and he says, you know, I'm glad I wasn't living here. I wouldn't be able to find my way home the way you've described it. Well, okay, Hawthorne, the map does it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really funny. Horowitz, you know, in the book Horowitz, he talks about getting notes all the time from producers, directors, actors, editors, copy editors, and now, you know, sensitivity readers. I keep throwing up quotes. Is it something that occupies your mind when you're writing a book about, like, well, what kind of note am I going to get after I wrote that sentence?
Laura, it's not books that are the sort of, you know, the where notes are the bugbear. It's TV and film. I mean, you know, when I'm running a TV show at the moment, and I've so far had notes from two sets of producers, from my American, the platform that is sponsoring the show. Later on, I'm going to get director's notes have come in. The lead actor, I'm meeting him later this week, sure he's going to have a few notes here and there about his character and things that he doesn't want to. So, listen, it's part of the game. I mean, notes come. I have an editor at Penguin Random House who always gives me about, I would say, for every novel, there'll be 3 or 4 pages of notes. And it's part of the game. I don't dread it anymore, because I think the most important thing for a writer in some ways, especially a starting writer, is to really analyze each note you're given and decide, first of all, is it right or is it wrong? If it's wrong, can you still put it in just to keep the editor happy and not to have to have a row? Is it really that important? Does it matter? Can you change it without sort of, you know, without spoiling your own sense of what you've done? And finally, the note that you just say, well, actually, no, you've just, this is not right. I had that recently in a book where somebody wanted to take something out. And I said to them, no, you can't, because this really is what this book is about. And so it stayed. So it's a question of knowing which one to fight for and not to turn the whole thing into a fight. Indeed, if you can avoid it, never to fight. I mean, you know, these people, producers, editors, actors, they may not always be right, but they are sort of on your side and they want to help.
That's a good point. And it does come from experience, because I feel like a younger writer will either get hung up on something that they refuse to let go, and then the publisher doesn't want to work with them, perhaps. I don't know if that's
true. I met sort of a newish writer last weekend, and she told me about this idea she'd had, and the publisher had said, no, we're not interested in that sort of period stuff. And I said to you, you know, that's the best idea I've heard in a long, long time. That's a Netflix series you just told me. And, you know, don't be kowtowed by what your editor, publisher thinks. If you believe in that idea, and I'm telling you it's a fabulous idea, write it anyway. I think that is, you know, for writers, a writer is always balancing the needs of his own or her own imagination and inspiration against the publisher's desires. After all, they're investing in the book. They have a right to have an opinion on what's inside it. And of course, the audience. You know, you've got to think about what your audience wants to read. So, you know, in a book like Close to Death, I'm thinking to myself, you know, the murder's got to happen soon. We can't take too long to get there, because people are going to get fed up reading. And you know, the characters are going to behave in a way that is attractive and interesting and involving. You can't, you are always thinking of the reader too. But unfortunately, the readers don't get to give notes until it's too late.
That's good.
Well, and in this book,
well, unfortunately for them.
And in this book, though, you get to have a little fun with that, because, you know, you're getting the notes from Hawthorne as he's giving you the notes from the case from back when. And, you know, you're commenting on it like, we need to get to a murder really, really quick. All these books are very meta to begin with. This one, I feel like, takes it up to an 11.
Well, this one is different in a way, because the other four just have were murder stories with me as the sidekick following Hawthorne. And I've come out of book number 5 in this series, and I've always in my career been very wary of formula, of books being too similar to each other, of trying to shift things around a bit and do things that surprise an audience. So for book number 5, I've done something which is very different, which is, this is a cold case. It happened 5 years before I even met Hawthorne, and he now has a different sidekick, a guy called John Dudley, who has sort of got my place already. My heckles are rising as I learn about this guy who is much, much smarter than I am. And there's that happening. But for various reasons, I have to write this book with Hawthorne. He's the only one who knows the ending, and he's reading the book as I write it, which, of course, creates all these metafictional style arguments where he's saying to me, that's wrong. Yeah, and as you just said, it's time to get a murder. People are going to get fed up reading this. And sort of, you know, always questioning the whole activity, the whole art of writing.
Right.
So that it was a lot of fun to write for that reason, because it just takes what I've done in the first four books and sort of takes it in a new direction and extends it.
It seemed like it'd be a lot of fun, and that would be my guess. And also, yeah. I mean, we get some hints. There's some darker stuff going on, which is really exciting for me. So you're saying you always want to have something be different, but it seems to me like the whole series is starting to take a little bit of a turn, and that's very exciting for me.
Well, we are heading in a sort of strange direction. I sort of, you know, I'm thinking there are going to be 12 books in this series, and they're going to lead to the question which is being asked now in every book: who is Hawthorne? Why is he so damaged? What happened to him as a kid? What is his background story, his origin story, as you might say? And the closer I get to it, I think the darker things become, because I do have a sort of a very good idea of what happened and where and how and why and to whom. And that you won't reach until the very end. And because it's quite a sort of a, because it is quite a sort of a dark ending, I'll be glad there won't be any more books after it. I mean, all my readers will say, "Hey, that's it. We don't like this. Stop." So no, I don't think it's not that bad, but it is. You know, Hawthorne is without any question a difficult and unhappy man. Yeah. Not in every respect. He doesn't come across as unhappy, but there's something wrong. And I think one of the great fascinations about writing, especially writing series, is the more you write, the more you get to know your main character, like the Alex Rider books, 14 books. By the end of those, I knew pretty well everything about him. In this series, I have to go search it. I have to go to the town, to where he was born, meet his friends, and find out.
Yeah.
How real does Hawthorne sometimes feel to you? Do you ever find yourself just thinking about him idly during the day?
Well, he's sitting on the sofa over there. Actually, yeah. Listening to that with a great degree of annoyance, Laura. What the hell? Are you telling me I'm not real? No, I do feel he's a real character. Of course, yeah. I do, because he's, yeah. You know, he is real to me. Certainly, you know, the Anthony in the book is real. He's as real as the Hawthorne character. So, you know, you can't say that one is real and one is fake. They sort of live together in that sort of fictional world.
Love that. Love that.
And I love the line in the book where you say, quote, "Either I'm weak or I like writing too much, but I always seem to be locked in a room with a ream of A4 while other writers are out and having a good time." Is that an accurate depiction about you?
I'm so happy you noticed that line enough to be able to quote it back to me, because that is my life. I mean, I'm sitting here at this desk surrounded by A4 paper. And I've been here since pretty much 6 this morning, and I'm sure there are other. I'm sure the two of you have been having more fun than I've had today. But that said, no, I'm not complaining. Writing is my life. It's my great love. It's my great pleasure. I'm privileged that my books, you know, have an audience, and that I can continue to write them. And so I just sometimes, you know, get a little bit sort of that feeling that all of life is sort of passing me by, and I'm going to look in the mirror, and I'm going to be even older than I am now.
Where's the skull? Last time we talked to you, there was a skull behind you. Did you lose it in the move?
It's still there. Where? Top shelf. It's just one shelf.
Oh, maybe it's up too high. We can't see the.
Dave wants to see the skull.
Oh, thank you. Now I feel much better.
I just climbed up one shelf too high.
Thank you. All right. We'll bring Yorick down a little bit. Now, listen, you have a character in your book, Adam Strauss. He is a, quote, terrible name dropper. And, you know, he gets chastised for dropping names all the time. I feel, look, if I live in the life of Anthony Horowitz and meeting all these famous people all the time, I would be a terrible name. In fact, I've already told people that I'm going to talk to you today. So I'm already guilty of being a name dropper. Are you a name dropper?
You know, I have to tell you let me just think, who told me this? Somebody said a very interesting thing. He said, "There is nothing more common than name dropping." That was said to me by Stephen Fry, the famous actor. There you go. And so, no, I try not. I mean, look, I have been fortunate enough to meet a lot of pretty famous people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as you get older, you realize that no matter how famous somebody is, they're the same as you. They're, right, they're, yeah. they're, you know, they. I think people forget that. People ask me questions sometimes about, I don't know, war or politics you know, the environment. And I want to say, look, what do I know? I mean, I'm a writer. I'm a kids writer. I'm a crime writer. I don't know anything. I think that you know, the most famous actors I've met probably left school when they were 15 or 16, and they don't know very much either. They are still my heroes and heroines, and they are fantastic to meet. But I've sort of, as I've got older, lost that sense of, oh my God, it's. And I, therefore, when I'm talking to my friends and in conversation, I don't tend to sort of say, hey, when I was meeting this guy or that guy or whatever.
All right, Laura, go ahead and scratch the next three questions.
In the books, there are one or two famous people who crop up in meetings with me.
Yeah.
So I do name drop in the books.
All right. we're going to skip our next three questions about politics and the environment then.
Okay.
Oh, very good, because I didn't have any answers.
Who does? For God's
sake.
We're
trying not to think about it in our country right now. Yeah. So at one point...
Well, I'm trying to say, politics is one thing I thought. I mean, the reason we read murder mysteries and we're reading books is to try and pretend that politics aren't happening.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
I have to say, I couldn't, you know, since you've mentioned, I will say I have my concerns for you and for your country and I suppose for the world. I mean, depending on what happens in the next 9 months.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's not even joking. We are very, very concerned.
We are frightened out of our minds, for sure.
So at one point in the book, Horowitz, he's getting the story from Hawthorne. He's very frustrated that he's not getting the whodunit from him. Do you know whodunit from the get-go in the book? Are you someone who just kind of discovers it as you go along, or is that kind of the one thing? How much of an outliner are you, I guess?
When I'm creating a murder mystery, I start with a notebook. I have more behind me here. Where's the one which I'm working on?
Oh, yeah.
Here's my notebook for the book I'm writing at the moment. And this has got, and I'll do it fast so you don't actually work it out, but this is the book as it begins.
Oh, I mean, wow. Cool.
No, there you are. That's all the interconnecting characters. And this is all the sort of questions. This is more about the characters. This is the stuff in red tends to be the most important clues. This is how the crime is committed on that page. There's pretty much nothing I don't know. I mean, every single thing is worked out. This is just one book. There you are. That's all the different clues that have got to be in the wrap on that page. There are no screenshots allowed.
No, it's an audio podcast.
That's the work of it. So the answer to your question, Laura, is that of course I know. Yeah. I have to really plot it. This is an extremely complicated novel. It's 150,000 words it's going to be. It's another in the Moonflower Murder series, Magpie Murders, Moonflower Murder.
Oh, great.
Awesome. And now the next one. And they are spectacularly complicated. I mean, there are just so many characters and this and that. And again, it comes back to what I was saying at the beginning of our discussion, that to me, I have to play 100% fair with the reader. I have to make it that anybody can solve the books, that all the clues are out there on the page in front of you, that you're never lost. You know exactly where you are within the story. And I may have said this to you the last time we spoke, because it's an analogy I often use, but I think what a murder mystery is a little bit like a Swiss watch, that if you think about what's inside this, if you opened up the back and took out the insides, it's you know, I don't know what it is actually. It's cogs and wheels and springs and little zinc things and all the rest of it. And you'd never get it back together again because it's so complicated. Glance at it and you know the time. And that, I think, is how a murder mystery should work, in exactly that way.
That's awesome. Your notebook also was visually pleasing.
It really was, yeah.
Looks like a private detective. Like, I imagine them solving a crime or serial killing, all that kind of stuff. It looks like that. It was cool. It's very cool. Yeah.
Thank you. No, I do. I mean, I love my notebooks, I have three or four of them for all the books I've been writing in my time now. They're all piled up as sort of part of my legacy for my kids to throw in the garbage the moment I pass on. But I keep them because I think they are. They're for me, they're an interesting record of my head. And sometimes I go back to the notebooks and I look at the beginning, the very beginning of it, and the finished book is so different. You know, it just changes as it goes on. And that's, you know, again, the analogy I sometimes make is that you can't explore a city. Which city are you guys calling me from?
Denver.
Colorado.
Oh, Denver. I have been to Denver, Colorado in my time, but not for many years. But you couldn't explore Denver without a map. You couldn't, you know, what are the tourist attractions? Where are the best restaurants? What streets will get me there? But a map, which is the same as those books, a structure of a book, the map of a book, doesn't mean you are tied down to one direction. It's the exact opposite. By having the map, by having the structure, you can go any direction you want, and then you know how to get back to where you need to be.
That's awesome.
So that's why I do that amount of work. And I sometimes spend as much time planning a book and thinking about it and structuring it as I do writing it.
Hmm. Is that the more fun part for you?
It's all fun. I love every part of it.
That's great.
Thinking up, I think the most fun I have is thinking up the idea. You know, this book I'm writing at the moment, I didn't know what it was going to be about. And then, I still remember the moment the idea fell into my head. I was walking the dog. Not so much of who was going to get killed, but what was the area, the region, the sort of the theme of the book going to be? What was the landscape going to be? I mean, you know, was it going to be in the world of hospitals and doctors or schools or theaters? Or, you know, it was that sort of question when I was trying to think of. And I suddenly realized there was an area I had never covered, which I knew a great deal about and which I've always been fascinated by. And that will be the story. And that moment when that idea just falls into your head and you say, yes, that's what I want to write about. That's the next book. That to me is the most exciting, because then everything else follows. Then you begin to think about, so you've got your world, who's killed in it, why, what's a weapon, who is the killer, what's their story, and it begins to sort of just explode. But you've got to have that sort of initial idea, and that's what I think is the most fun. And I just am so grateful, I'm so bedazzled by the fact that I can still have ideas. You know how it is that, you know, as the rest of my body goes to pot, my one bit that's looking to be working is the bit that thinks up stories.
That's great. So you're here first, Anthony Horowitz's next book set in Denver, Colorado. That's fantastic. We're very excited about that. So when you go out walking the dog, what kind of dog do you have, by the way?
I have a black Labrador.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. So you're not the kind, I picture you like just lost up in your thoughts. Like you're not popping in headphones and listening to an audiobook or music. Are you just attuned to what's going on?
I should do. I'm trying to learn a foreign language, and it'd be really good when I'm walking to have put earbuds in. In fact, I even have a set in my pocket right now. But
there you go.
But I do like to keep my, I think walking the dog is a wonderful time for just listening to nature and enjoying the landscape and having a rest, but at the same time, letting those ideas just percolate and thinking a little bit about, especially if I go out for a walk and I've got stuck, just thinking about where I am. So I can't have music and I can't have words in my head.
Right.
Yeah. I'm also kind of curious too, when you were a young, like a teenager, were you writing, were you having those same thoughts that came over you? Like, do you remember when it started?
I do remember very vividly. I was 10 years old when I decided I was going to be a writer and wrote my first sort of, you know, piece of creative writing for myself rather than for the teachers. And I remember the library at my school where I found my happiness and safety. It was my safe place in the school. I was in a very, very horrible and violent and corrupt school. You know, you probably know, but in the United Kingdom, there were many private schools for children back in the 60s that were cesspits, that were really dangerous places. Oh. And books were my escape, and writing was my joy. And I knew with an absolute certainty, I can still remember late at night in bed practicing my signature for the day when I would be in a bookstore signing books.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Sweet, sad in a way, but that's how I was.
Yeah, no.
That's really cool. Now, Anthony, you talk in this book about how much, or you claim that you dislike locked room mysteries, despite the fact that this book is just a stellar example of a locked room mystery. How do you really feel about them? And are you good at figuring out the whodunit? I'm not. I'm terrible. I have no idea. But I just like to read the story. I just loved your story, so I don't try to figure it out. But I'm curious.
Well, thank you again for the nice end to that question. I don't like locked room mysteries, actually. I talk about the ones that I do like. I mean, I mentioned the Japanese writer Soji Shimada, I think, is in there, and one or two others who have created great locked room mysteries. But the ones I also mentioned, Gaston Leroux, I think, is probably in there, and maybe Poe. You know, I find the problem with locked room mysteries, as I say in the story, is that often the mechanics of the crime, the sort of Heath Robinson sort of eccentricity of it, overshadow the reality. You know, murder mystery is in essence not about murder. Murder is only the excuse. If you murder Laura or she murders you, it will inevitably make us ask about your relationship and start thinking about you in a different way to if we just meet you in the supermarket. The murder is committed for strong emotions. In a murder mystery story, you don't murder somebody because you're mildly cross with them or because you don't like them very much. It's going to be much bigger than that. To risk your life, your liberty, or if it's in the 1950s, your life, you know, your whole, you will be executed for murder in some American states still now. But to risk all that means you are really at your most extreme. So that's, I think, the fun, the pleasure of murder mystery stories is it introduces you to people at the moment when they would most like not to meet you, which is a really sort of fun sort of way to read a book. And so a locked room mystery, I think, takes away from that because you become much more interested in the how did the key get into the pocket? How did the guy then get into a cellophane bag, which has been done with sellotape up at the top? And why was he hanging upside down from the ceiling? And why is there a paint pot on the floor? And you think, you know, and at the end of it, the writer may tie all these things together in a way that is brilliant and makes you smile. But I don't think it's actually a very human way of writing. So that's why, although I admire locked room mysteries, and as I said in the book, you know, the Tokyo Zodiac murders is one of them, and the Crooked House is another, and there are many, many great examples. They generally aren't the ones that I most love. The ones I most love are the ones that, you know, one of my favorite murder mysteries is The Mirror Cracked from Side to Side, Agatha Christie. And the reason I love it is that the motive for the murder is so utterly human. You completely understand why somebody decides to kill this famous actress when in some English stately home, and when it comes down to it, your sympathies are as much with the killer as you are as with anybody else. And I think that is to me the sort of whodunit that I'm interested in writing. And at the end of this book, you know, the one we're talking about, I think that the reason for the murder is what makes what I like most, more really than the method.
Right. Yeah. Splendid, splendid. Well, listen, Anthony, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for talking to me. Tell me that it wasn't so difficult as you said it was going to be, as advertised. I didn't do any slapping or whatever it was you said I was going to be doing.
Well, once you brought the skull down, everything was fine. So
I felt better.
No, the skull still smiles on me. Yeah. Waiting for me to join it, I'm afraid. Oh, dear. On which cheerful note, guys, have a very, very good, happy day. And thank you again for your time and for your interest. Have your lovely questions.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Enjoy have a good day. Bye.
You too. Bye.
The Inside Flap.
All right, there you go. That was Anthony Horowitz. Check out his book, Close to Death. Always great to chat with him. Really enjoy that. Okay, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
Yeah, let's start with
Laura Medicus.
She comes from Silver Spoon, Golden Rule, private school, never missed on a church.
Laura, what do you got for us this week?
First of all, I want to give a shout out to my cousin Jenny.
Yes, we do.
Who is a listener of the show. Although, to be perfectly honest, I don't know if she listens to the book reviews. I don't know if she makes it this far into the show.
She falls asleep by this point? Is that
what
you're saying?
At this point, yeah. She might have tuned off. But Jenny, if you're listening, we are glad that you are doing okay.
Yes.
So my book this week is called How to Solve Your Own Murder.
I had this one on
hold at
the
library. It's a great title.
Yeah.
I got to it first.
You did.
So this is by Kristen Perrin, and it's new, and it's book one of the Castle Knoll Files. So this is a cozy mystery, and it sounds like she's got this author has more books in store too. So I feel like we talk about genres, or at least Andrew and I talk about genres on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I think this falls into a particular type of genre. I don't think it's named, so I'm going to name it, and I call it the inheritance genre. So I really love inheritance stories. Usually, you know, you find out you've inherited an old house somewhere, some land.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
There's typically a stipulation that you have to, like, live in the house for a year or do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do something odd, you know, that comes with this house. Typically, also, you don't know the relative very well or at all so that the writer doesn't have to, like, get bogged down with grief, basically.
Right.
So I like that genre, and that's what this is. So in this story, you have a young woman who unexpectedly finds out that she might be heir to an enormous country estate. After she gets called to her great aunt's home for a meeting, and she finds her aunt murdered. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, wow, I got it right here.
Thank you. Okay. So the solicitor, this is a British book, he calls the family together and he tells them that per the aunt's will, the person who solves her murder, they have 1 week to do it.
Oh.
The person who solves her murder will inherit the estate.
Hey, I like that. That's great.
How did the great aunt know she was going to be murdered, you might ask?
I would like to ask that.
Okay. Good question. Well, she spent her whole life obsessing over something a fortune teller told her 60 years ago when she was a teenager. The fortune teller gave her a cryptic note with all kinds of weird clues in it. And the last sentence said, quote, all signs point toward your murder.
Ooh.
So this woman has murder boards up in her home.
Hmm.
She has notebooks. She has file folders on people in the town, on her family. She has basically been trying to solve and get ahead of her own murder ever since she had that fortune told. So it's not just the great niece, whose name is Annie, who's at this estate trying to solve the mystery. It's a whole cast of other characters who also have some skin in the game. So it's a very entertaining read. It flashes back in time with a diary that the aunt kept that Annie finds while she's there at this estate with the present day. And it is a race to be the first to solve this murder. And it's excellent. How to solve your own murder.
That one sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah, I can't wait to read that one. All right. That's recommended by
Laura Medicus.
And my book this week,
Dave Medicus.
It's a bonfire. Turn the lights out. I'm burning everything you motherfucker.
I have for you, now listen, nobody loves a good vampire book as much as I do.
Oh, I love a good vampire book.
Well, maybe you do.
I think I like it better.
You think so?
Personally, because I even like the sparkly vampires, as they say.
Oh, that's all.
I like all types of vampires.
That's true, you do like the sparkly
ones. I'm not a vampire snob.
This is not a sparkly vampire story.
That's okay.
This is The Lesser Dead by Christopher Buhlmann. It's got a nice biting wit to it. You see what I did there? Thank you. Mm. That helps it.
Andrew would appreciate that.
Often I found myself with a big smile on my face as I was reading this book, a smile that would quickly turn to an open mouth gape of shock or horror. The story is told from the first person point of view by 14-year-old Joey Peacock. Of course, he's 14 years old when we first meet him. Later on, he still looks 14, but he's been living for 60 years as a vampire. So he's 74, but he appears to be 14, as it goes. You know, those vampires.
Sure.
It is New York City in the 1970s. Joey and his crew are living in abandoned underground subway tunnels. He's enjoying his life as a vampire, feeding on the odd human here and there, until one day he sees what appear to be vampire children in the tunnels, coming out of a subway train.
Ugh.
Uh-huh. And his life is turned upside down.
Hmm.
I love Joey's voice. He's got something sardonic or funny to say about everything. He's constantly commenting on the action. Very funny. The book is also incredibly gory. So you're into the gore like I am. It's a bonus for you. It's action-packed. It's fast-paced. It's an enjoyable entry into the vampire canon. So check it out, The Lesser Dead, and it's got plays with all the vampire mythology. You have to be invited in. Sun will burn you up, all that stuff. He has a lot of fun with that. So check it out, The Lesser Dead by Christopher Buhlmann. Andrew
Dow.
So I have a space opera.
Ooh.
So I don't know if it's been a while since I've reviewed a space opera.
It has been a while.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
Welcome back,
so
space
this
opera.
This book is called Star Scrapper, written by Matthew Goodwin and J.N. Chaney. And I know I've reviewed J.N. Chaney books
that
before.
That sounds familiar, yeah.
I'm not sure if I've reviewed a Matthew Goodwin book before. I'm not sure if they have collaborated before either. Didn't research that much, but the book Star Scrapper, the main character in this book is Hank Spears. Hank Spears is an orphan. This takes place in the far, far future. And he is an orphan on a planet, and he is caught breaking into a scrapper's shop. Now, what is a scrapper?
I was just going to ask, what is a scrapper's shop?
We will get to that.
Hmm.
So
I've heard enough of these space opera stories that I have a guess.
Yep. You're probably right. And so
I think I have a guess.
So basically, but the scrapper basically decides to adopt Hank as his own son. He's like, hey, you can work, can't you? And he's like, yeah. He's like, well, why don't you come to work for me? And it turns out that, you know.
You know, you see that being done in movies in the old days where there's a thief or whatever. And then the shopkeeper's like, oh, you could work for me. Do you
know
what
true,
I mean?
That's true. Yeah. Yep.
It's an interesting little trope. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And we watched a movie like that recently where.
Oh, did you?
The girl is stealing a bird, a pigeon.
Oh.
And I forget what it's. I don't know what
that's
it's called.
Different.
But the little girl steals the pigeon and she ends up becoming, you know, close friends with the person she stole the pigeon from.
Yeah. That's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, heck. I guess maybe that should be a genre.
I feel like that should be a genre.
And that Don Winslow book I recommended last week, Cool Breeze in the Underground, he was a con artist on the streets of New York, picked a pocket of the wrong person, and then went to work for that guy.
So we call that the cookie jar genre?
The cookie jar genre. I like that.
Yeah, yes.
Let's coin that.
I like that.
Yeah.
So good one.
So another. This is a...
Who stole the cookie
jar? A space opera cookie jar genre.
Yeah, I like that.
So he ends up getting adopted. And it turns out the scrapper's like, well, Hank, you saved my life too, because I was, you know, I had no meaning to my life. I was lost. And so like it worked out for both of us. So he became his adopted father and really became the father that he never had. Now his dad was also an alien, like a different race.
Okay. Now you mention it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and humanoid, but somebody that I guess this race is considered like extremely strong. Like there's a scene in this book where, you know, let's just say an alien of the same species basically decides to pulverize somebody's head.
Oh,
wow.
You know, so I'm guessing they're pretty strong. So in any case, but you know, his father, adoptive father died. So Hank is on his own and he's struggling to run the scrapping business on his own. Now, what exactly is a scrapper, you may ask?
What is a scrapper, Andrew?
And a scrapper is somebody that has a spaceship, basically will go out and investigate space wrecks, you know, crash ships on planets, and basically will salvage what they can. Hmm. They may also fix ships as well. They may, like, repair ships that have been damaged. You know, so it's kind of like, you know, I guess the future, like, welding shop, you know? A little bit of everything.
Yeah, like a junkyard kind of guy or a tow truck.
Yeah, a little bit of that all. Like
AAA.
A tow truck driver, junkyard guy, all rolled in one.
Love it.
And so this book doesn't get too technical, like how they can go light years and like no time at all. They don't, I mean, they talk a little bit about it, but it doesn't really get into that. It's more about the story. So if you are looking for a technical sci-fi book, this probably isn't it. You're just looking for a good space opera cookie jar genre. Yeah, it just rolls off the
rolls off.
Cookie jar genre.
Nope. So, of course, he's on a job in a HG planet. Now, Dave, any idea what a HG planet is?
Human growth.
Hydrogen gas.
Closer,
planet?
Closer. A high gravity planet.
High gravity.
Right. So it's the planet where the gravity is maybe twice Earth normal.
Okay.
And so
it's not a home and garden.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about it, imagine like going to do a salvage job on a planet where gravity is twice what it is on Earth. So, you know, you feel like, you know, if you're 200 pounds, you feel like 400 pounds.
Wow. Yeah.
And so he's basically on a job like that. And it's an old shipwreck buried beneath the surface of this planet. And he, of course, finds a small cube. Now, everything, you know, let's just say he gets chased off before he can investigate really what's going on. So he runs out of the ship, you know, basically running for his life. He's got this cube. He has no idea what it is, but it was like within arm's reach as he was being threatened. And so he took off. Well, it turns out the small cube is an AI named Ned.
Cute.
And AI is now forbidden. Like in this future world, any forms of AI is forbidden. Any forms of human enhancement with technology is forbidden. And when I say forbidden, there is a... Let's just say there is an inquisition, basically out there, and if you're caught with AI or they even suspect you have AI or enhancements, they will incinerate you. Mm. Right? They will not ask questions. They will, you know, pronounce you guilty on the spot. So AI and anything like it is forbidden. Well, you know, here he has discovered Ned, and, you know, his initial thing is, well, you know, I know what happens if I get involved with AI. I need to distance myself from this. But of course, Ned has a personality, and he starts to tell his story. And his story is that Ned and his pilot partner, 200 years in the future, they defeated, like, the evil AI. They saved humanity. And then they crashed on this planet. And Ned has no memory of exactly what happened, but they crashed on this planet. And his pilot is, you know, dead within a few feet from where Ned is found. But Ned survives in a, you know, in a stasis mode, in a power conserving mode, you know, until Hank picks him up. But, you know, Hank is listening to his story, and he's like, I mean, here's this individual, like, because Ned really comes across as a person who gave everything and saved humanity. Now, 200 years later, the people he saved basically want to obliterate him. You know, and Hank is a good guy, and he's like, he doesn't immediately, he doesn't know what he's going to do. Well, before Hank figures out, am I going to help Ned or not, basically the Inquisition, it sets off an alarm, and the Inquisition finds out that he has AI technology, so he ends up having to run for his life. So the decision is really taken out of his hands. And I think that is a nice approach to this, because Hank is conflicted, but, you know, once you're caught, also sort of with your hand in the AI cookie jar. So this is double cookie jar genre right here. You know, he's already guilty, right? And as far as the Inquisition goes, they don't care about the story. You possess AI technology, you are going to be obliterated, right? There's no point in sticking around, and so he doesn't. Now, what Ned also reveals is that, you know, before he crash-landed on this planet 200 years ago, and Ned is the AI, they had discovered a threat to humanity, the alien artificial intelligence that was defeated was pursuing a project called Extinction, right? And a project to, you know, exterminate all humans or all life in the galaxy. And, you know, Ned basically tells Hank about this is, you know, we need to find out what's going on with Extinction, you know, and what happens. And so, you know, that's what this book is. It is sort of also a out of the frying pan, into the fire, you know, into the volcano. you know, so basically there is no place safe. There is no respite. It is a fast moving book. But it's book one of Star Scrapper, written by Matthew Goodwin and J.N. Chaney. And I'm already reading well into book two.
Oh, that's great.
And I don't know how many books are in the series, but I'm guessing just more than book two.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. Yep. All right.
Is it a long book?
I didn't look at the number of pages.
They typically are, but I was just
probably
curious.
400. I would guess 400 pages.
Yeah. Star Scrapper, I can tell you right now, comes in at 366.
Oh, not bad. Not bad. That's good.
Not too bad. And it looks like that is number one in the series. And there are four books in the series.
Great. Four books and counting, probably, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And counting, yep. All right, that means it's time for our audio book of the week. And listen, stop me if you've heard this one before. But I have another book by Liz Nugent. This one, as I'm going through the Liz Nugent catalog.
Look at you, man.
This is her very first book from 2014. It won the Crime Novel of the Year at the Irish Book Awards, and it is another good one. So we meet Oliver Ryan at the beginning of this book. He is a successful author of a series of children's books, and his wife, Alice, illustrates the books. And they seem to have a successful marriage. They seem happy until one day, Oliver viciously attacks her. The book then, and that's where it starts. And then the book goes back in time as we begin unraveling Oliver to find out how he got here. Hmm. We get pieces of his life from the 50 years before this, and we see them through the eyes of the other characters as well as Oliver himself. This is a fascinating book as we are treated to this portrait of a life that keeps getting more and more interesting the farther it goes along, taking place in both Ireland and France and going all the way back to World War II. This is a book that will leave you absolutely floored, I promise.
She is just so great at plotting and setting things up. You never know. Nothing is ever the way it seems. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Unraveling Oliver by Liz Nugent, and it is narrated by Sam O'Mahony.
Friends are just people who remind you of your failings. I have several acquaintances. I have no family either to speak of. Not in the sense that matters. Over the years, Alice has never pried. She has never been too curious. In fact, I would describe her as habitually obedient, with just an occasional rebellion. I am not, have never been, violent. I went to the bar and bought a packet of cigarettes. Strong ones. I was worried that my hands were still unsteady. Isn't brandy supposed to help at a time like this? Or is that an old wives' tale?
Audiobook of the week!
All right, there you go. Another Liz Nugent for you.
All right.
And that will do it for us this week. Thank you so much to Anthony Horowitz for hopping on. And thank you for listening. My name is Dave Medicus. See ya.
Adios.
Excelsior.
The only answer, Dave, is murder.